closed strings correspond to specific D-brains, and which open strings propagate within pairs of D-brains. But this is a surprisingly rich subject, even just for simple D-brains, just because there are so many possibilities. So let me just first focus on a single scalar, and then I put together the 26 scalars of spacetime to describe general D-brains. So the condition for a boundary condition to be diffeomorphism invariant or conformal invariant, meaning let me step back for a moment. So yesterday I discussed the condition for diffeomorphism invariant, but actually I lied a little bit, meaning that the condition, I wrote down a condition which is stronger than diffeomorphism invariance alone. I wrote down a condition that actually allows for wild invariance. Let me just give some general considerations about conservations of charges in the presence of a boundary. This is a problem you can, this is a question you can already ask in electromagnetism, right? Suppose you have some current which is conserved in the bulk, and you want to define a boundary condition which preserves the symmetry. The charges which define the symmetry are things like the integral over space, of the time component of the current. So this charge, if the space is, if the space does not have a boundary, satisfies trivially that the zero Q is zero, because you bring the derivative inside, use the conservation, integrate by parts. If the space is a boundary, this becomes the integral over the boundary of space-time of the normal component of the current. Just by replacing the zero with the mu j mu and integrating by parts. Integrate by parts a derivative, when you integrate by parts a total derivative, you get the integral of the normal component along the boundary. Now, if you want this to be zero, it's a bit too strong to say that you want the perpendicular component of J to zero at the boundary. What you could have is that the perpendicular component of J at the boundary is itself the derivative, a divergence of something else, where A runs along the boundary. Okay, so essentially, physically, if I want a current conservation and I have a boundary, setting this to zero would mean that you don't allow any current to flow in and out the boundary. But if you have some boundary degrees of freedom, you can imagine having some current that lives at the boundary. So if charge could flow in from the bulk into the boundary, and from the point of view of the boundary, would be a violation of the boundary conservation. But together, they make the total charge conserved. So similarly, for the stress tensor, the condition is that the perpendicular component, the components of the stress tensor, which are one perpendicular and the other parallel to the boundary, should be the divergence of some sort of a boundary stress tensor. Okay. Now, in two dimensions, So this is enough to have guaranteed the form of this invariant. But if you want wild symmetry in two dimensions, then you really need to have tip parallel perpendicular equal to zero. So this is wild plus diffeomorphisms. This is just diffeomorphisms. Let me just specialize it to two dimensions. So this only has one component. So that means if I give a generic boundary condition and you want to know if it's wild invariant, you need to compute this and make sure it's zero. So this is sort of the boundary version of the condition of the for the stress tensor to be traceless. So the same way as in the bulk, we said that we can take the trace of the stress tensor and expand it in terms of operators to get beta functions or the bulk couplings. In a similar way, you could take the parallel component. Well, you could take the component of T. Let me just say it properly. You can take this guy and expand it into sort of boundary operators. Operators that live at the boundary. And you get some beta functions essentially for couplings of the boundary. So there might be different possible choices of boundary conditions. There will be couplings that live on the boundary, and there will be RG flows for boundary conditions, even if your bulk theory is already conformal. And so there will be conditions for the boundary conditions to be conformally invariant, which are similar to the beta functions for the theory to be conformally invariant, to be wild invariant. And the same way as these ones sort of give you the equations of motion for the closed strings, setting this to zero, essentially give you the boundary, the equation of motion for the open strings. So we'll get to this at the end of the lecture, but I just wanted to amend the statement I made yesterday. Now, let's specialize to a scalar field. So in holomorphic coordinates, the condition I'm looking for is that T equals T bar at the boundary. And for a single scalar field, because T is minus 1/2 dx dx, there are two obvious ways to make this work. One is to set dx equal to d bar x, and the other is to set dx equal to minus d bar x. Okay. Now, depending if your boundary is vertical or horizontal, these are Neumann or Dirichlet. So, let's look at the cylinders. Let's put a boundary at tau equal to zero to see which state is created by boundary. Let's run the random mode expansion on the cylinder. So, if I want to set non-homomorphic conditions at tau equal to zero, it means I want the tau derivative of x to vanish. So somehow the state created by non-boundary conditions should satisfy properties like being annihilated by P. And being annihilated by An minus A bar minus N. So if you stare at these equations long enough, you can write down a solution. Okay. So N is a state which is created by setting a non-boundary condition at tau equal to zero.
And how can you see that?
So I just imposed the tau x n equal to zero. And I expanded it in Fourier modes.
And that condition is got by that.
Yeah, so for example here, when I do the tau derivative, right, I pick down a minus an plus a bar n. Okay. I mean, I hope I got the sign right. You can check me out. So what does this mean? So which sort of closed string states do we see here? Well, and if I expand this, I'm going to start with a vacuum. Well, every state I'm going to get has zero momentum. Why is that? It's because non-boundary conditions are invariant in the translations of x. So the source is spread around the x direction and doesn't produce any closed strings with momentum. It creates a token with zero momentum. And then the next will be something like a minus one bar over the vacuum, plus the dot. So this ultimately is going to create some closed strings with massless closed string modes, and then massive closed strings, and so on. See, the D-brain is creating sources of equal magnitude for all the closed strings. So it's an object which definitely tries to push you beyond the low energy approximation. Okay, it really sources all the closed strings. They are massive, so the very massive closed strings are not going to go very far from the D-brain. But you can imagine that if you try to approach the D-brain at distances comparable to the string length, to alpha prime, then you're going to start seeing something, a lot of stuff that are non-geometric. If you stay far enough, you only see the changes in the metric, maybe the tachyon, unfortunately, but let's ignore that. But if you get close, you'll feel the effect of all the possible string modes. So another possibility is to look at the Dirichlet boundary conditions. Then instead of constraining the momentum, they constrain the position. The Dirichlet boundary condition creates closed strings at a specific location. And then there is the same equation of the opposite sign. Which allows you to write down something like this. Okay. So I took a superposition of all possible momentum modes to get an eigen value of x. And I put the same exponential, but with an opposite sign. Okay. So now we can put together a bunch of free bosons to make the full spacetime. So the stress tensor for several free bosons is just the sum of the individual stress tensor for the free individual free bosons. So the simplest possibility we have is to just set independently Dirichlet or non-boundary conditions for each coordinate in space-time. So you can define a DP brain as something which has non-boundary conditions for x0, just because we want our sources to exist for all times. And then for x1 all the way to xp. And Dirichlet boundary conditions for x p plus 1 all the way to x 25. So let's write down the source for a DP brain. So we have an integral over the momenta in the directions perpendicular to the brain. There are 25 minus p of them, I think. E to the I x 0 dot perpendicular. And then there is a sum. Something like a parallel dot a parallel minus a perpendicular dot a perpendicular. Okay. So let's expand. So this is going to start with a So there is no momentum in the parallel in the direction parallel to the brain, but there is generic momenta in the direction perpendicular to the brain. So this looks like a point-like source for the tachyon. Not a point, like a source localized in space at the position of the brain. And then there is a source for the graviton and dilaton. So how does this look like as a source for a graviton? If you think about it as sort of a stress tensor in space-time, it's a stress tensor which has a very simple form, has a bunch of ones followed by a bunch of minus ones. Don't confuse this with a stress tensor on the worksheet. Okay. And you can convince yourself that this is pretty much, that this is a very reasonable stress tensor for a featureless object which lives in p plus one dimensions and has a certain tension. Here there is both the stress tensor and the coupling to the dilaton. So from the point of view of gravity, the D brain looks like a generalization of a particle. Okay. Some object with p space dimensions, featureless, with an isotropic tension. Okay. And then you get, as I was saying, a source for the dilaton, meaning that depending on the dimensionality of your D-brain, the dilaton might become very large or very small close to the D-brain. Okay. Now the next set of questions is what kind of open strings live. Actually, no, sorry. Let me step back for a moment. So these are the simplest possible dbrains we could consider. But in general, the total stress tensor is dx dot x mu d x mu, and t bar is t bar x mu t bar x mu, which means that the simple way to ensure that t equals to t bar is to ensure that d bar x mu is a rotation an orthogonal transformation acting on dx. So this is sort of the simplest, sorry, the most general free boundary condition for a set of free bosons, which preserves wild invariance. And it's quite interesting if you convert it into a statement about normal derivatives and transfer derivatives, sorry, and parallel derivatives. So these ones are the sum and the diff. These are things like the perpendicular plus I the parallel, or the perpendicular minus I the parallel. I do not write down the precise formula, so I'd probably mess this up. But let me just assume I'm doing it right. So you get equations which look schematically like this. Now, what is the physical meaning of Neumann boundary conditions? Neumann boundary conditions are just telling you that if you have your dbrain and you have a string stretched to it, the string wants to end it perpendicular, end on the source perpendicular. It's essentially telling you that no force is acting on the endpoint of the string. So if you want your string to be in equilibrium, the endpoint of the string must be perpendicular because the string has a tension. And if you try to have it end at an angle, it would pull and move. On the other hand, this equation is essentially telling you that the string likes to end at an angle, which means that there must be a force acting on it, acting on the endpoint of the string. So it turns out that, and we'll find it momentarily, there is an electric field. There is a gauge theory living on the dbrains. And the endpoints of the string are charged under the gauge field. This boundary condition corresponds to turning on a constant electric field, which pulls the endpoint of the string. Conversely, if you recognize that this is a constant electric field, and you remember that continuous deformations of an object in string theory always correspond to excitations of string theory, you can see this is a prediction that there will be a gauge field on the dbrain, because we found a constant electric field, and so there must also be fluctuating electric fields in the theory. Okay. Sorry. Okay. Now I think we're ready to move to open strings. So I want to start by considering a strip with no boundary conditions on both ends, both at sigma equal to zero and sigma equal to pi. I'm going to write down the expansion of the scalar field in such a strip. Okay. So, first of all, I had to make the Fourier modes conspire together, left moving and right moving, in such a way to get satisfy normal matter conditions, both at zero and pi. The second thing to observe is that I change the normalization of P in respect to the cylinder. Because the momentum is the conserved charge associated to current, which is the derivative, the time derivative of x. And I'm integrating this current on half as much distance to get my charge. So I need to double the coefficient. So now that means that I can build a Fock space of this. There's going to be momentum modes. And I'm going to be able to act on the momentum modes with a single set of oscillators. So the state of this is the space, state of space, the space of states of an open string with no boundary conditions. You can have generic momentum, and there is one set of oscillators. Now the generic momentum kind of makes sense. A Norman brain is an object which extends along this direction. And so open strings attached to it can just move freely on it. So this time L0 on P is two P squared of P. Okay. So when you impose the condition that L0 equal to 1, you're going to find, first of all, a tachyon with P squared equal to minus 1/2. Then you'll find a massless mode. And then you'll find massive modes with masses my n over 2. Because there is a 2p squared here. Well, if you remember, closed strings had masses 2n squared, 2n. Okay. So now, if I put normal boundary conditions in all directions of space time, I can just put a generic index here. You see that this massless mode carries a polarization, which is a vector. So it's a gauge field. As usual, in order for this to be Q exact, the polarization has to be transverse, and longitudinal modes are Q exact. So in order for this to be Q closed, the polarization has to be perpendicular to the momentum, and the polarization is parallel to the momentum, the state is Q exact and decouples. So we find a photon, pretty much, living on the normal plane. And a tachyon. Now this tachyon is actually less troublesome than the closed string tachyon. Does not represent an instability of the whole string theory, it represents an instability of the D-brain itself. And it's actually possible in certain control setup to study the decay of the D-brains. So even in superstrings, there are configurations of brains which are unstable. So So if you build and they have a tachyon, then you can study their decay. Now, there is a small variant of this construction where you put several copies of a dibran. Putting several copies of the dibran essentially means that the boundaries carry a label that tells you which brain are you sitting on, are you ending on. The spectrum is completely unaffected by this label. So all that happens is that now you have n square sectors. You have one set of open strings for every pair of boundary conditions. So now you get gauge fields and other fields which are matrix valued. So the polarization has extra indices. And when you compute some scattering amplitude, say of these photons, you consider configurations on a, sorry, I should. You consider configurations like these, where I had two ribbons, three ribbons coming together. When you join these ribbons together, if this ribbon was between brains A and B, this one would be between brains B and C. This one would be between brains C and A. If you have looked, if you've seen any non-abelian gauge theory, this picture should ring a bell. Is the same way as the indices in a UN gauge theory match together in computing a scattering amplitude. So automatically the metric structure of the interactions between these gauge bosons mimics the properties of a non-abelian gauge theory. Now, in a sense, this had to be the case because, as usual, string theory reproduces quantum field theory at low energy, and there are theorems that tell you that if you have some massless gauge bosons interacting with each other, they must form a non-abelian gauge theory. So these vertices must be the structural constants of some non-abelian gauge theory. If you consider just standard dibrans in flat space, you get a UN gauge theory. And this should be really striking. Rather unexpected, right? Because even if you expect to have fluctuating modes associated to deformations of a brain, it's far from obvious that when you bring n brains together, you would have n square deformations of them and n square fluctuations living on them. And I mean, this is really deep consequences all through modern theoretical physics combining with holography at the SFT. But for now, let's look at some other possibilities. Suppose I want to study a free boson between two Dirichlet boundary conditions. Okay. Then the expansions look like this. The zero mode would be fixed. Well, let me just focus on one single Dirichlet boundary condition for now. So I put both boundaries at the same location. So this looks very similar to a normal brain. The main difference is that there is no more momentum. So clearly, if an open string is stuck to a brain and the brain is localized at this point in space-time, the open string cannot move. the central mass will be stuck there. So I just get a vacuum, a ground state with oscillators acting on them. So if I go back to this example up there, the Fock space will include states with momentum parallel to the brain. So you get a tachyon living on the brain. And then you get both you get two sets of massless modes, one with the polarization along the D-brain and one with the polarization transverse to the D-brain. So the ones with the polarization parallel to the D-brain represent, again, a gauge field on the D-brain. These other guys represent the fluctuations in the position of the D-brain. Now, that means that if I have n D-brains placed at the same location, even the positions of the D-brains are magically promoted to matrices. So if I take a bundle of n brains very close to each other, I'll have a non-abelian gauge field. And a set of position fields. Which are matrices. Now this looks very strange. Now, to understand a little bit better what is happening, we can try to bring these D-brains away from each other, separate them in space. So we can look at the open string stretch between something, say, at x0 and something at x1. So it turns out that to satisfy these boundary conditions, you just need to add an extra term here. So this extra term contributes to the energy of your ground state. So the ground state between x0 and x1, I hope I wrote it down, has energy x1 minus x0 squared over 8 pi squared. So that means that if you start separating your D-brains, you consider two separate D-brains, you have some massless mode which is attached to each brain and describes the fluctuation of the D-brains, of each individual D-brain. And those diagonal modes become massive, with a mass which is just related to the distance of the D-brains. But if you look at it from the point of view of the original theory, this is a Higgs mechanism. So to give a separation to the brain, we turn on a valve for the scalar fields, which is diagonal. If you give this valve breaks the gauge symmetry, makes a bunch of gauge bosons massive while eating up some of the scalars. So there's a beautiful correspondence between the quantum field theory process and the physical process of separating the D-brains. By the time you separate them, you end up with just a billion gauge theory living on each brain, plus some massive stuff stretched between them. And in a sense, this promoting the field to matrices is the way the string theory deals with indistinguishability of the D-brains. See, here, you could permute these valves among themselves, and it would just be a gauge transformation. The true gauge invariant notion is things like the trace of this, or the trace of the square of this. So sums of functions of the individual position of the brains. Still, it's a pretty peculiar way to implement indistinguishability. Now, of course, if you have time and energy, you can generalize this in various ways. For example, you could ask what happens if you have Dirichlet boundary conditions on one side and Norman boundary conditions on the other side. You end up with modes which are half integral. In order to have Dirichlet boundary condition here and Norman here, you need to consider waves which somehow have unusual spacing compared to the ones you would use for Dirichlet or for Neumann. And so the so you get a variety of different phenomena and different excitations, where when you have D brains which intersect each other in different ways. You can study things like brains at an angle and so on. I want to just point out here that because of this extra energy, even the ground state, if the distance is sufficiently long, is not a tachyon anymore. So when you bring two D brains in, at some point a new tachyon appears. Now, in superstrings, it's possible to. There are D-brains which are stable, they don't have a tachyon, but they have a charge. So you might have a D-brain with charge 1 and a D-brain with charge minus 1. As long as they are far enough, they're stable. If you bring them sufficiently close, though, the string stretch between them becomes a tachyon and lets you know that they want to decay. So this is the first hint that the D-brains really want to be very dynamical in string theory, not just support dynamical degrees of freedom, but be dynamical objects themselves. They want to be able to decay or appear. Okay, so I wasn't planning to do specific calculations of scattering amplitudes in the presence of D-brains. Although it might be, in principle, instructive. You don't need a new particular new ingredients with respect to what you already know. You need to understand how to compute correlation functions of vertex operators in the presence of a boundary. And perhaps, how to do the state operator map for open string states. So I would just like to discuss this second point. So how does state operator map work for open strings? For closed strings, the state operator map is what allows us to take a semi-infinite tube or a surface and replace it with a puncture, with an insertion of a local operator. Right. And as you remember, the sort of the equal time circles on the cylinder become the circles around your point. Now, if you have a long ribbon, now, if you have a boundary now with a semi-infinite ribbon and then some Riemann surface, you can use a val factor center which shrinks the ribbon down. What you find is a point on the boundary So open strings become operators that leave the boundary. So which kind of operators do live on boundaries? Well, for example, if you have normal boundary conditions, we know that the normal derivative is zero. But I can still consider the parallel derivative at the boundary. This is an interesting operator. As you can guess, it corresponds to A minus one acting on the vacuum. If you want momentum modes, you need to consider things like e to the I dx at the boundary. Now, in defining this operator, you need to be a little bit careful in the sense that there are divergences which are slightly different for an operator on the boundary and an operator away from the boundary. Essentially, you can deal with boundary conditions by using the method of images. So the propagator between two points in the presence of the boundary looks like the propagator between the two points plus the propagator between the point, one point and the image of the other point, plus or minus, depending on Neumann-Dirichlet boundary conditions. This means that if you try to define this guy by defining it away from the boundary and bringing it in, you find collisions between the field and their image. So there is a slightly different subtraction, which ends up being responsible for the slightly different value of L0. So when you subtract something involving a slightly different propagator. And so the anomalous transformation of this operator under conformal transformations gets changed a little bit. Sometimes in the Polchinski, he has a special symbol for this, something he calls a boundary normal ordering, which is this sort of different subtraction. But concretely, calculations are rather straightforward. So so if you have a bunch of vertex operators in the bulk and a bunch of vertex operators in the boundary, you're going to get the usual product of zi minus zj to some power from the bulk operators, then maybe some zi minus tj, some other power involving the boundary and the bulk operator, and then ti minus tj, some other power involving the collision of two boundary operators. And these powers are essentially, I mean, they can be derived in a very straightforward manner. I'm not writing them down because I didn't write them down on my sheet, and I'm going to get all the powers, all the factors of two wrong if I do so. And so, so using these, you can start computing scattering amplitudes for open strings. Say, if you wanted to study this problem, you would look at the disk with three insertions, and then something like dx e to the I p1x, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. Right, and similarly for Dirichlet boundary conditions. For Dirichlet boundary conditions, you can insert at the boundary the perpendicular derivative of x and things like that. On the other hand, there are no vertex operators. But on the other hand, there were no states. So of moment with momentum. Now there are calculations which can get trickier. For example, if you want to do calculations where your brain's at different angles or things that interpolate between Dirichlet and Neumann, then it gets a bit harder. But it's still free field theory, so everything is doable with a bit of patience. Now, perhaps I can briefly mention equations of motions for the open strings, or actions for the open strings. Again, I seem to have not printed a sheet, so I'm short on formulae. But let's at least set up the problem. So I said D-brains are dynamical. So let's see what's the most general dynamical thing you think of doing to a D-brain. If you have some object in space-time, what can you do to it? So these ones were all straight and living on big planes. Simplest thing we can do is to make it curvy. Okay. You could take boundary conditions where X at the boundary is constrained to live on some manifold inside space-time. So this should be augmented with the condition that there is no force on the endpoints of strings. So I get something like the normal derivative of X should be perpendicular to the manifold or something like that. The normal derivative of X on the worksheet should live in the direction perpendicular to the boundary, meaning it should have normal boundary conditions along the manifold and Dirichlet perpendicular to the manifold. These boundary conditions are classically okay. They're definitely diffeomorphism invariant. But they have a wild anomaly. So you can compute carefully the sort of beta functions for the boundary couplings as a function of the shape. And so you end up with some action for the D-brain, which turns out to be rather intuitive in nature. So you get something like the square root of the determinant of the induced mesh, an integral over this manifold, or the square root of the determinant of the induced metric. So these D-brains are going to behave pretty much in the way you would expect some elastic objects to behave in space-time. Now, you can try to add to this things like couplings to the B-field, to the dilaton. You can include the gauge field living on the D-brain. And you get something called the DBI action. There is some nonlinear action, such that you roughly end up adding the field strength to this before you take the determinant and the square root. Okay, do you have any questions? Any more curiosities about D-brains? Okay. So tomorrow we'll start looking at some background material for superstring theory.